The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
If you are going to treat early on in certain cases with the monoclonal antibodies, make sure that these are patients who really are patients and that amyloid is not just a byproduct of normal aging.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call features an article titled "The Certain Uncertainty of an Alzheimer's Disease Diagnosis." Joining us on the podcast is the author of this opinion piece, Gayatri Devi, who's a physician neurologist in New York City, practicing neurologist, who's also an attending physician at Lenox Hill Hospital. We believe that you'll learn much about the diagnosis of Alzheimer's by listening to this podcast. Thank you for listening. Gaia, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I was really fascinated by your article about the uncertainty of the Alzheimer's diagnosis. It wasn't something that was on my radar. And so I thought it's not on the radar of a lot of my colleagues either. So I have a number of questions to ask you so I can not be as ignorant about diagnosing Alzheimer's as I am right this minute. And the first is, one of the reasons we want to diagnose it early is because of MAB, or MAB. What is it, and why is it important?
Well, Rob, thanks, first of all, for having me on your podcast. So monoclonal antibodies, or MABs, are really drugs that are targeting monoclonal antibodies against amyloid, which is a brain deposit, which is felt to be the earliest pathologic change that's associated with Alzheimer's. It's extracellular deposits of amyloid in the substance of the brain. Although it is common as we get older, it is always the first sign of Alzheimer's. So you cannot have Alzheimer's without having amyloid. And if you can target and treat amyloid early enough, the hope is then you can prevent the deleterious effects of the amyloid, presumably.
So in talking to one of my colleagues, he said, that's pretty controversial. So, and you're a neurologist. How controversial is the use of these monoclonal antibodies, and why are we trying to go there?
Well, these are the first drugs that have been used in this particular condition that may actually alter pathology as opposed to modify symptoms. So they're very exciting in that regard. The problem is that amyloid is common as we get older. So a quarter of us in our 70s and nearly half of us in our 80s have amyloid. So the question is, how much of that is really pathological? And in truth, as we get older, it seems as though our brain gets more resilient in the face of amyloid. So if you are going to treat early on in certain cases with the monoclonal antibodies, you want to make sure that these are patients who really are patients and not just, you know, that amyloid is not just a byproduct of normal aging, which is the contention of many people.
So that leads us to one of the things that I find very exciting, and that is, how do we make the diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and therefore how do we make the find out that someone whose parents had Alzheimer's is at risk for Alzheimer's? And you wrote beautifully about this, so if try explaining it to me.
All right, so what's interesting is currently there are two ways to diagnose Alzheimer's. One is the Alzheimer's Association 2024 criteria, which require only the presence of a positive amyloid, whether it's in serum or in cerebrospinal fluid or with an amyloid scan. The presumption there is that many of these patients, or all of these patients who have this positive amyloid, will eventually go on to develop symptoms and tau. So, based on those criteria, the Food and Drug Administration has approved the use of monoclonal antibodies in people who have amyloid with symptoms. The International Working Group 2024 criteria, which is a large group of 45 primarily clinician scientists, have said that while amyloid puts in certain patients, there is higher risk for developing Alzheimer's, they actually require the presence of amyloid tau, which is an abnormal intracellular protein that's far better correlated with cognitive impairment and symptoms for making a diagnosis. The concern, of course, is if you use the International Working Group criteria, which are far more conservative, you may miss the opportunity to intervene at an earlier stage for patients who are genetically at higher risk for Alzheimer's.
So tell me about that genetic risk.
All right. You have early onset Alzheimer's, which is Alzheimer's prior to the age of 65. It's a very uncommon group of people who develop this. Less than 5% of the population who have Alzheimer's have this type of Alzheimer's, and that's usually related to mutations in the presenilin genes. And those are fairly rapidly progressive and usually resistant to treatment. Then you have late onset Alzheimer's, which is Alzheimer's that presents after the age of 65, and that is most commonly associated with the APOE4 allele, which is one of the isoforms of the APOE gene, the other two isoforms being APOE3 and APOE2. But the APOE4 allele confers increased risk for developing late onset Alzheimer's, which is the most common kind. And if you have two copies of the APOE4, then similar to the BRCA gene and the risk for breast cancer, you have about a 60% lifetime risk of developing Alzheimer's. So this is a group where you really can make a difference if you intervene early enough.
Well, one of the things I really liked about your article is you gave us two case examples. And I often tell people the best way to give a talk is to present a case that helps us better understand what the points we want to make. So why don't you present the first case from your opinion piece, and then we'll contrast that with the second case.
So the first case, these are actual cases that I saw in my office. The first is a physician who's a 53-year-old woman who had dementia in both her parents and who has an APOE4 genotype. In other words, she's homozygous for the APOE gene 4, APOE4 allele, that puts her at the highest risk for developing late onset Alzheimer's. Her Mini-Mental status score, however, was 30 out of 30. And her MRI of the brain is normal, and she had extensive neurocognitive testing, which places her at the 61st percentile for her age without any significant cognitive deficits. However, when I did her spinal fluid analysis, we found that her tau level was her tau level was normal, but her amyloid was abnormal, which is worrisome. So here's a woman who's very young, two copies of the E4, strong family history, and low abnormal levels of amyloid in her cerebrospinal fluid. So this may be a person who is very highly likely to develop Alzheimer's down the road. So we'd categorize as genetically high risk.
So, as I understand these monoclonal antibodies against amyloid, the idea is to start treatment before they have any significant amount of amyloid, and that perhaps that will help. Do we have good enough data to believe that? And in that first case, if I remember right, you sat down with the patient and made the decision, let's try it, because you're at such a high risk. Is that a common practice now, or is this, are we talking about state of the art?
Well, I would say it's more state of the art because actually monoclonal antibodies are approved in the United States only if you have symptoms. So she doesn't yet have symptoms. She only has the abnormal amyloid. So she'd qualify from that regard. And certainly by the Alzheimer's Association criteria, she meets criteria for Alzheimer's. But by the International Working Group criteria, she does not meet an Alzheimer's diagnosis. But she's at high risk, genetically high risk. So in this situation, it's kind of cutting edge, I would say. We're using available treatment to hopefully prevent development of Alzheimer's in this young physician and hopefully prevent all the downstream accumulation of tau as well as the synaptic loss. Ultimately, it's the synaptic loss that causes the clinical symptoms.
Okay, so this is an attempt to prevent the development of Alzheimer's. So let's talk about the second case, which is quite different.
I also say, Bob, on our patient, she did have abnormal amyloid. So by some criteria, she meets the definition for
Right.
Alzheimer's disease.
So
Yes.
she didn't yet have clinical Alzheimer's. She had medical.
She had medical Alzheimer's by one set of criteria, the
Right.
Alzheimer's Association criteria, but not by the International Working Group, which
Right.
also requires tau. Yeah.
Right.
And symptoms.
Okay. So
So
let's go
the
to the
second,
second case because it's quite different.
yeah, the second patient also, I think, is the kind of patient I'm seeing a lot in my practice, which is she's an architect, 65-year-old woman, who'd had progressive cognitive and functional loss, and she meets the criteria for dementia, who has one copy of the APOE4 genotype. Her Mini-Mental status score was 26 out of 30, so she has impairment. And her neurocognitive testing places her at the first percentile compared to her peers in recall, language, and executive function. Her MRI showed some white matter changes, but no atrophy of the hippocampus, which is often associated with early Alzheimer's. What's interesting is that she did have an abnormal amyloid PET scan and her CSF also revealed abnormal amyloid, but her tau levels were normal in her cerebrospinal fluid. So this is a woman who actually meets American, the Alzheimer's Association 2024 criteria for Alzheimer's. She has symptoms because she has amyloid. And she would also meet the FDA requirements for administering of the monoclonal antibodies. However, my feeling was she has no tau, zero tau on testing, a normal tau on testing. And my feeling was that she didn't have Alzheimer's. She had another type of dementia that was causing her cognitive impairment. And it wasn't Alzheimer's pathology that was driving her cognitive impairment. And I discussed both sets of criteria with the patient, her husband, and with the internist, and we all collectively decided that we were going to hold the monoclonals. And the main reason to hold it, aside from the cost and the inconvenience of going in for your infusions, is it also causes brain bleeding and brain swelling, which can, in some patients, cause death. So it's not a simple decision. And therefore, we withheld monoclonals in her case. And her diagnosis was that because it was limbic predominant age-related TDP-43 encephalopathy, which easier way to remember that is late. And that can also present with cognitive problems.
So this is fascinating. It's most fascinating to me because you're opening up a door to a part of medicine that I didn't understand real well. So I want to play the part of the primary care physician who the patient comes in and the patient is concerned about Alzheimer's. Seems like a strong family history is going to lead us to do some testing, and then actual early dementia is going to lead us to do some testing. So, from your point of view in dealing with the internist or the family physician, how important is it for each of the primary care physicians to have a relationship with a neurologist who is interested in dementia and goes through this so that they can order the right tests, do the referrals, so that we can try to make good decisions given the upside and downside of trying these monoclonal antibodies and not doing it in the wrong patient? So that's a really long question, but I think that you can answer that real well.
Well, thank you. I'm going to try. So the issue is we have so many people now who have cognitive symptoms, who are older, who want to be tested, and they want a quick and easy answer. It's almost impossible, I'm finding, certainly in New York, with my internist colleagues, and I'm sure elsewhere in the country, to be able to get in to see a specialist to get the test necessary in any reasonable time frame. So it's very appealing to have blood tests that can give you brain, the levels of amyloid and tau. And in a symptomatic patient, I think as an internist, if you have amyloid, abnormal levels of amyloid, abnormal levels of tau, plus objective evidence of symptoms with a mini mental status exam, even, and you have some idea of the APOE4 status, it may be worthwhile starting monoclonals if it's hard to get in with a specialist, especially a cognitive neurologist. And I think most of these decisions are going to be made more and more at the primary care physician's office because of just the bottleneck with specialists.
So let me make sure that I have this down right. So patient comes in, either they're worried because their parents had Alzheimer's, or they think that their cognition is falling off and they want to see, is there anything they can do early? The internist or family physician or whomever should order tau and amyloid levels. And if they're really concerned about the genetics, go ahead and get an APOE4 genetic testing. And we could order all that from our office.
Yes, you could. And the reason it's important to get the E4 testing is because the APOE4 allele is associated with a higher risk of side effects with the monoclonal antibodies. So the homozygous E4 patients are also most at risk for brain bleeding and brain swelling, what's called amyloid-related imaging abnormalities or ARIA. But these are also the patients with the most aggressive disease. So you want to be careful to have those levels before beginning any kind of treatment. And a slower titration seems to help ameliorate those side effects.
Well, you have opened up a part of neurology that I wasn't aware of, and I bet many of our listeners have not been aware of. And it's given me food for thought, even when I have friends, because I'm of the age where people are getting these kinds of problems, and somebody asks me, I can better tell them what they might ask to have done, especially also to find a cognitive neurologist if at all possible. So I can't thank you enough for writing the article and for being so patient to explain it to us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Bob. And if I may just leave with one caveat that I feel is very, very important, not just amyloid, but tau also really matters in making the diagnosis. So you want abnormal levels of tau.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. The first thing that I learned from doing this podcast is that dementia does not equal Alzheimer's, and that we need to be more precise in making a diagnosis in patients who we believe have dementia, of what kind of dementia they have. This might be very important in Alzheimer's because we're starting to better understand how we might modify Alzheimer's. We talked a lot about monoclonal antibodies against amyloid that seem to show some promise in slowing down the progression of amyloid. And there's the hope that by diagnosing people prior to many symptoms, we might be able to delay or prevent the dementia that occurs with Alzheimer's. Important things that I learned is we can test for genetic predisposition to amyloid from ApoE, E4 genotype, and especially if it's homozygous, the patient's at high risk. The other thing is most experts believe that in order to make a firm diagnosis of Alzheimer's dementia, that we need both to find amyloid in one of several ways, as well as have elevated tau levels. I hope that this podcast has made you think about how to address patients who have dementia and when to do testing and when to do referral. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.